Hey there. Welcome to the round table. I'm David Gustina filling in for Joe Donahue today. It's a Friday. We love Fridays, but it's a big Friday in the news. And with us to discuss some of that news is our panel, partner with Albany Law Firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hannah, Sienna Freeman Tolbert. Good morning.
Good morning. I just gave everyone the asterisk. I was trying to catch up on all these Supreme Court decisions that are dropping today. And so, you know, bear with me.
We'll follow your lead.
And listeners, bear with us because we may be going over to live coverage from NPR of the Supreme Court, which is expected to issue its decision on the remaining cases of the term. Of course, birthright citizenship is among them. It's supposed to kick off at 10. You know, we don't know exactly when it'll happen. The panel has agreed to hang around depending on how long that lasts. And speaking of the panel, up next, professional speaker, speaking coach, and Albany County legislator Mark Grimm. Good morning, Mark.
Good to be with all of you. A lot to discuss, right?
There certainly is. Aaron Pasitti is no stranger to discussion. He's professor of economics at Siena College. There's even some economics in the news today.
Yeah, there's always economics in the news. Even some of the court decisions have economic components, which, you know, aren't the main issues, but in terms of what happens if they get passed. So, yeah, never a dull moment in the 2020s.
No, never a dull moment.
For better or worse.
And you can make our moments even less dull by writing to us at panel@wamc.org. Keep your letters short, to the point, and on topic. Don't include links or attachments, please. Don't use abbreviations and proofread your emails before you send them. We appreciate that. Again, panel@wamc.org. Now to the Supreme Court today, expected to make lots of decisions. Where do we want to start? Anyone want to jump in? Sienna?
Oh, I mean, we start with Trump v. Casa?
Sure, go ahead. Tell us a little more.
All right. Okay, so here we go. So first of all, Trump v. Casa is what everyone is lauding as the birthright citizenship case. As everyone has been saying on the news, you probably know by now that the underlying facts are about birthright citizenship, but this case is not about birthright citizenship. It's about whether or not, it's about the scope and the power of the judges, the federal judges, and whether or not they have the power to enact a nationwide injunction on issues such as, in this case, birthright citizenship. So that's what this is about. What do we expect? We expect either a 9-0 decision where they uphold the judges, federal judges' right to enact nationwide injunctions. This is important because this allows us as a country to not have backlogs in courts, right? And so if you do a nationwide injunction, everyone does not have to sue for an injunction, and you kind of can wait for the merits of the case to come or for the case to move up to the Supreme Court. What I think is going to happen is option two, is a limited scope kind of jurisdiction where they say that you can, federal judges can utilize nationwide injunctions only in special situations having to do with constitutional rights such as freedom of speech, freedom of religion, things like that. That's what we're expecting to come because that's kind of like middle ground. And then last but certainly not least, the third option would be them eliminating the rights for federal judges to enact nationwide injunctions, which would be, in my humble opinion, a terrible option because that means that you'll see a lot of lawsuits coming out of people would have to sue in individual districts in order to get their rights. So that doesn't mean that birthright citizenship is going to happen if they do option three. What that means is the executive order gave 30 days to enact this new policy. So what it means is in this next 30 days, we will see an influx of lawsuits, a class action lawsuits that would come up, and then you would see judges and federal judges in different districts enacting injunctions. So that's what would actually happen in practice. I'll leave it there, unless you guys want to talk about birthright citizenship.
Well, my concern, of course, a judge is there to uphold the Constitution. That's why we have judges. But my concern is judges are, in many cases, are more interested in advancing their policy point of view than they are upholding the Constitution. So can we really have one judge upend national policy that was decided by elected representatives in the House and the Senate and the presidency? So I think there is a concern. It's a tough issue because I want judges to uphold the Constitution because that's what they do. But I think some judges have abused that And that's creating the problem as far as I can see.
Doesn't that come with judge shopping?
Judge shopping, that's exactly.
Right.
And both sides do it, by the way.
Both sides are doing
it. One thing that's bipartisan is that they both go judge shopping.
On the state level and the federal level.
On the state. Well, we saw that with redistricting and all that. Yeah.
It's called forum shopping. Forum shopping.
Forum
shopping.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Either one works.
Yeah.
Aaron.
They get what you're saying.
I remember, so I'm not a legal expert, and Sina did a good job explaining the kind of the bigger issue. It's not exactly about birthright citizenship, but kind of a larger issue about lower judges' power. But I remember when I was on with Bo Breslin from Skidmore, he presented some data and said that, I forget if it was going back to Obama, but about like 10% of all executive orders get challenged and an injunction's imposed, which I thought was interesting. So like no matter the volume, it seems to be around 10%, which is a surprisingly low number. But the other interesting thing to point out is that, you know, this ruling is going to affect both Democrats and Republicans. So, you know, you have a Democratic president, say Biden, who's trying to do a student loan forgiveness program, and then you can have one judge rule against it, and then nationwide it flops. So I think this has, you know, this will have a substantial impact on how executive orders and what they're able to accomplish going forward. And we've seen with President Trump that that's his legislative strategy. It's not passing bills through Congress. It's just a muzzle velocity, as Steve Bannon said, of executive orders. But with the birthright citizenship, kind of getting back to the root of this, I think there's a story, an economic story that I just want to touch on liberally. One of the concisely. One of the biggest headwinds facing long-term U.S. economic growth is slowing population, which means a smaller labor supply. So if we get rid of birthright citizenship as part, you know, as kind of a downstream effect of this ruling, or just the intimidation of immigrants as a whole, that, you know, lowers labor supply, which pushes up wages, which most people argue would be a good thing, because if there's fewer workers, firms have to compete and push up wages. But a lot of those workers that would be targeted by this are working in sectors and markets that domestic workers don't want, like agriculture and slaughterhouses and these really low-paying, dangerous jobs that are paid under the table. They're paid sub-minimum wages. So, you know, there's an odd thing where you're going to see a business revolt, like in the hospitality industry, in agriculture, saying, yeah, but we depend on these undocumented workers because we can pay them sub-minimum wages under the table, and that's what keeps prices low.
That's already happening without this decision.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. But I'm saying this would accelerate it.
Sure.
And long story short, too late. We would see higher prices for food, higher prices in the hospitality industry due to, you know, kind of a restriction of the labor supply.
Well, my question is, if that begins to happen, doesn't that impact all voters, whether they're Republican or Democrat?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
I mean, specifically, I wanted to, what this executive order is asking for is basically anyone that's in the country that's undocumented or does not have any lawful status, their children would not be citizens. And then furthermore, it goes further, and it goes to anyone who's here on a temporary work visa. Now, that's a big deal, and that hits a labor market that you didn't mention, and that's, you're talking about your H-1B workers, your tech industry workers, right? So here they come on an H-1B. They're here for, and a lot of people from India and China, they're waiting for over 20 years for a green card, right? And to not give them at least the benefit of having their child who was born here and who may age out into 21, may turn 21, and they still, where does this child go? Does that child go back to their home country? No, because the child was born here. Now the child is a U.S. citizen. They can go to school. They can move on. They can work. And it's those implications as well. When you include people like the temporary workers, that's a huge market. And that's a very big deal.
Sienna, are you saying, by the way, Sienna, are you named after the college at all? Or?
Spelled differently.
Spelled differently.
Oh, spelled differently, yeah. Because there's a couple of Sienna grads here and myself. Even if you're here legally, and but you're not a citizen, you have a child, that child would not be an American citizen.
Yes, they're saying under the executive order, it was if you're here lawfully, but temporarily. And those are your H-1B workers. Those are your L-1 workers. Those are your student visa holders, individuals getting their PhDs, right? Those people as well.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense because you're actually doing it legally if you got a card, green card.
But the idea behind their argument is the language in the 14th Amendment that's subject to the jurisdiction thereof or hereof, I forget. And basically what they're saying is these individuals don't have allegiance to the U.S. They're not subject to our jurisdiction. They're subject to the jurisdiction of their home country. And thus their children should not have status. And that's what they're saying.
Okay. Yeah, that's a tough lift, I think, a heavy lift.
But isn't this, forgive me for using an analogy here, but isn't this a lot like the Doge cuts where they really haven't thought it through, looked down the road and seen the impact of what might happen?
Well, they've made it clear that they're going to leave farming and hospitality alone.
Now.
Yeah, you can't. We want immigration. We just don't want the bad people coming in. And we had open borders for 4 years, which is a disaster, which will have ramifications for decades. There's some really bad people that have come into this country, and we need to get them out and let the farm workers who are willing to pick lettuce all day long just to help their family. That's part of what has made America strong. But neither side has really ever come together on this sensible approach where the bad people stay out and we have a managed program. How much can we manage appropriately to have an influx of legal immigration? That's what we need to fix as well. So it's not either or. It often seems like that way in the debate.
Well, once again, they're playing politics with an issue as opposed to searching for real solutions.
Well, the question is, why did Biden let open borders in? And there's never been a sensible answer for that. And they said, well, we need legislation. Well, no, you didn't. Trump closed the borders in a matter of a few months.
I mean, I would argue that I don't think the borders were open. I think what you saw happening during the Biden administration, for the most part, where you saw them having individuals come to the border if they were caught, then they would go through some sort of screening, biometrics, what have you, to see if they had a prior removal order, any other criminal history. If they had no criminal history, then they were paroled into the country and they were placed in immigration court proceedings to apply for asylum or what have you. If they didn't have a valid application, their application is denied and then they're removed from the country. Like that was, I think that's what we were seeing in happening in practice.
Siena and Siena grads, didn't we witness the Vice President Kamala Harris go to the border and say, turn around and go back home?
Well, she avoided that issue like there was no tomorrow. And, this is a great success for the Trump administration. They closed the border when people said it could never be done. And this was essential because we had an illegal immigrant who tried to knife the top prosecutor in upstate New York, the U.S. District Attorney, right across from our county office building. So, yeah, it's a problem. We need to fix it. And I'm afraid there's going to be ramifications for a long time. But we have to be clear that legal immigration done properly is a lifeblood of America. There's no doubt about it. And it has a huge impact on our farm prices, for example, our hotels. And those people just want a better life. And, that's the American dream.
I know the Biden administration is often maligned for the open borders and the surge in immigration during his term. But remember, that was the same period where businesses were screaming, we have a labor shortage, we have a labor shortage, we can't find enough workers. Can you imagine what that world would have looked like in the absence of the immigration surge? Like you would have had a labor shortage that would have been unprecedented in U.S. history. So there are arguments for sensible immigration restrictions, but the timing of the Biden open borders policy coincided with an enormous labor shortage in the U.S., and had it not been for that surge in immigration, what you would have seen was an even greater labor shortage. You'd have seen more business closures because they couldn't find workers and would just have to shut. Prices, inflation and prices would have been substantially higher. So I know he's maligned and it's like, oh, this was bad policy. The pendulum swung too far in the other direction. Yeah, but if you think about what would have happened in the absence of that, if you thought 10% inflation was bad, I mean, you probably would have seen 15%+ inflation during that period.
And we still have it. This hasn't played out yet.
No.
We don't know necessarily what this is going to mean.
Not until 10, yeah.
Well, but it underscores immigration should be about what's best for America, putting America first, if you will. So the people that we take are the people that we need that fulfill our purpose, and they're honest citizens, and they're not going to cause us trouble. But there's a lot of work to be done to get rid of the human traffickers and the fentanyl, and then just the horror stories that we've heard. And there have been cases of illegal immigrants. Well, the case in the Georgia co-ed, which really struck home because I have a co-ed daughter who's in college.
Yeah. Exactly. And in response to that, Congress has, they've enacted the Lincoln Riley Act, right? Basically.
Right.
So, and so I think that everyone agrees that there shouldn't be immigrants here who have broke the law. I think that is concise. But what we're seeing happening in practice is not that in the enforcement in the last few months. We're seeing them picking up people who have not broken the law,
who have
no criminal history. And I think that's what's more concerning. I think that's why you're seeing this uprising, this people speaking out against it, saying what's happening, just like what you're saying in these different industries. That's the concern.
But one of the problems ICE is having is that there's local municipalities that are not supporting them, and that's wrong. So
there is a program called Secure Communities, and anyone that is arrested in a local law enforcement, they are reported and their biometrics are done and they're reported into the FBI system. At that point, ICE is aware that the individual is there, and it's up to ICE to come and to pick them up in a timely fashion before they're released. And that's where you have the conversation.
All right. We have to pause for a moment. Now, are you hearing this, listeners? We need some letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We're just wrapping it up. Sienna, Mark, and Aaron are here with us to discuss these important issues. We'd love to hear from you, but first we have to take a little bit of a break and go talk to those people over the pond. Coming up on 9:34, you are listening to the Roundtable on WAMC. I'm David Gustina. We're in the panel portion of the Roundtable, if you're just tuning in. By the way, the music you heard was Danny Gatton, prepared for us by the amazing engineer, Mr. Mike Bowen. Couldn't do it without you, sir. Playlist posted online at WAMC.org/roundtable. Remember, email us at panel@WAMC.org. Keep those letters short and to the point if you could. That would be great. We're here with Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, with Mark Grimm and Aaron Presidi, and we've been talking about the Supreme Court and decisions coming down today, and we've started with birthright citizenship. Are we all done and all in on that? What are we doing here? That good?
Yeah, we can move on.
Fascinating discussion.
That was good.
You want to move on to number two? What do you think?
Let's move on to number two. I'll sit back.
No.
I'll sit too far back.
Please don't.
The court seems likely to side with Maryland parents in a religious rights case over LGBTQ storybooks in public schools. Parents in the Montgomery County school system, says the Associated Press, in suburban Washington want to be able to pull their children out of lessons that use the storybooks, which the county added to the curriculum to better reflect the district's diversity. That's a little bit of it in a nutshell. Who wants to start on this?
I'll start.
Okay,
just
Aaron.
Because Sienna was begging not to start.
Please, no.
I've got a broader view of this. I'm not a legal expert, but I can, so this is obviously one of the culture war issues that propelled Trump into the White House and is gathering a lot of support for his policies. But the concern is that, okay, so if it starts with parents being able to pull their students from LGBTQ storybook reading times in public schools, then what's next? Do they have the right to pull them from hearing about evolution? Do they have the right to pull them from any topic that the parent themselves might find objectionable, whether it's the ramifications of slavery, the rise in inequality, all of the issues that have been wedges in the culture war? I think you would probably see a domino effect about schools just saying, well, okay, this ruling allows parents to do this, so we really need to be more conscientious about what we present so we don't offend anybody. And when you start presenting very truthful but controversial topics like the rise in inequality, income inequality in the U.S. and how it's allowed billionaires to just buy their way into politics, the role of slavery in, perpetuating two centuries of racism, the role of evolution and what that means for, how people conceptualize science, that all of a sudden you're going to see a much more narrow, you're going to see a much more narrow range of opinions that are presented in public schools, which is the exact opposite of what schooling is supposed to accomplish. It's supposed to present, you know, a diversified view of, you know, scientific facts and things that have been proved. And it's, I think what we're heading toward is a choose your own adventure form of education, where if you don't like this, then you can, you know, go to this school and you have this type of education. And I think that defeats the whole purpose of public education, which is providing a intellectually rigorous foundation for people so that when they graduate high school, that they have some basic understanding of how the world works and what ideas shape society. If they go on to college, then those ideas are, you know, reinforced. So I see this as a really dangerous precedent. And again, throwing in the economic angle, what this does is if you shield people from unpopular ideas, that reduces their ability to critically compare things, leading to long-term productivity declines. You have an uneducated workforce. You have people who just, you know, think that this is true and that's true. And it's, you know, part of this anti-science, post-truth world that we've entered into.
And I would argue that part of this is religion-based, too, and this constant refrain that we're a Christian nation, and the Bible says, you know, and
that's
where some of this objection comes from. And I thought we were supposed to separate religion from our politics. But in any case, it's going to factor in. Mark, what do you think about this?
Well, I think how much say do parents have in their kids' education? It should be a lot. First of all, I don't believe yearly young kids should be bombarded with sexual education. That should be when they're older, number one. But one reason why I'm from school choice, it was Aaron saying, oh, we have this kind of school, that kind of school. Good. Mm-hmm. I want the parents to decide where they want to send their kids, and they'll get public money based on, you know, math and science. I think schools have become too political. They're not a forum political for political advocacy, but school boards have become that, maybe more than any other body I can think of. So it really should be what say should parents have in their child's lives, which I think is a lot, and there should be more choice so you can choose. If you want to send them to a Christian school, you can send them to a Christian school or a Jewish school or a Muslim school. That's up to you.
Should they get the public money to go with them?
Absolutely. The money should follow the student.
I disagree.
Well, that's okay. That's what makes the world go
round. That's right. I think that's 100% wrong.
I mean, I think, Aaron, you had some good points there. And I hear what you're saying about school choice. But I just want to speak, not legally, but just about the chilling effect that this may have on teachers, right?
Mm.
I mean, specifically, this lawsuit is about being exposed to, you know, education programs. But what about if a teacher chooses a book that, you know, may have a same-sex partner in the book just as a character? I mean, are they exposing them to this? So I think it's hard. And I think legally, I have a feeling that this court is going to, you know, write a very narrow decision that really focuses on this issue specifically, because there is the slippery slope that you're talking about. And I don't think, sometimes I think when you're pushing these type of cases, you forget about how it may affect both sides. Right? Parents on both sides of the aisle have a right if they make a more broader decision. And so I could come in and say, well, I want my kid to make sure they learn about the impacts of slavery. And so therefore, I don't want you reading that book about without the impact of slavery, like in Florida. It cuts both ways. And I think people fail to realize that when they're pushing these. So I think what we're going to see the court do is a very, very narrow decision based on the fact that this could be what we call a really slippery slope.
Well, and I got to tell you, out there in the land, I have a close friend, and I've heard this from others too, who literally said to me, they're trying to turn our kids gay. That's what he said. That's what they're doing in the schools. And he urged his daughter not to go into education because that's what they're trying to do. And I looked at him and I said, I don't know about you, but I don't think anybody can turn me gay. I don't think that's how it works. So this is the kind of stuff that's crept in. That this is what's happening in the schools. And as a person who has had his whole family in public education, that's not what they're doing. They're trying to give you the best information they can. And the idea that we can't criticize this country for its slavery is ridiculous. The idea that we have to only say good things about America. We have to be critical thinkers, not just rah, rah, rah champions for the cause of the greatness of America.
Well, the question is, whose rights are we protecting? Now, it's a free country. You can be anything you want. That's the beauty of America.
But can
when
you?
When you're trying to put a man into a woman's locker room, then the rights of the women are being infringed. So that's where we have to draw the line.
Should that take over the entire conversation about school when it's a very, very small, insignificant number that we're talking about?
Well, it's not insignificant. It's about whose rights, you know, as the Supreme Court Justice once said, the right to swing your fist ends at the point of my nose. Yeah. So when you're imposing on someone else's rights, that's the time to stand up.
Listen, we've had we've not had this in the past, and we've had coaches be sexually assaulting. We heard about what happened with the gymnasts. We heard what happened in Ohio State. I was just watching the other day, and those were in locker rooms that were same sex. I mean, and these are what's happening. And so you guys are not. It's not a protective mechanism for the students. It's not the rights of the parents always when it comes to public schools. It's the best interest of the children. That's what we should be concerned about. What's in their best interest? What makes them the ideal student? I want my child to be a productive asset to the U.S. who's a critical thinker. That's what I want my child to be. And then when they come home, it's my job to have those conversations about my views and talk to them about it, and they can agree or disagree. But I think this idea that we should indoctrinate them all the way through with what me as a parent believes is just, I don't think that's a good way to do it.
There's a bigger issue here, and I'm probably going to offend a lot of people, and I honestly don't care. These decisions...
Panel at WAMC.org.
Particularly with this decision, I mean, sounds like the death gasp of an older generation that has seen the world change so rapidly, both technologically, socially, and culturally over the past 20 years.
And they're afraid.
And they're afraid because they don't know how to handle it. And the way they handle it is through hatred and vitriol.
That's right.
Because it appeals to other people who just say, like, well, that's a foreign idea to me, and I don't know how to handle foreign ideas. And there's plenty of young people who probably agree with this too. But if you look at the current administration and what they're trying to pass, I mean, this just sounds like the death gasp of a generation that has been upended in how fast the world has changed. So instead of trying to acknowledge that and figure out some type of middle ground in how to proceed with this, they're just going all in on trying to block it. And, you know, they're swimming against the tide here. Time is on the side of people who think that this is perfectly appropriate in a public decision in a public school. And as Sienna said, if you disagree with that, then you can have conversations about that at home, or you can have there are gay people out there. There are transgender people out there.
They exist.
They exist.
So they walk into the school and you're like, oh, right. You can't read the book about them or these the program, but there they are.
These are students that are going to have to work with these people. They should know they exist, and they should know that they are just like everybody else.
Yeah, it's called the other, someone who's not like you.
Right.
You can either seek to understand who that person is or push them away, make fun of them, stereotype them, which is exactly what's happening.
Right. But let me see. That the issue is protecting rights of everyone. That's really
well.
What
this
we
seems
underscore.
Like.
And how much say do
how
parents,
are you protecting the gay rights much, by this decision?
Well, how much say do parents have in their kids' education? That's the friction that's going on right now.
Well, I think you got to ask, why don't the parents want that?
Want what?
Why don't they want their kids hearing about gay people?
Well, I don't, you know.
Let's take another group.
Said that everyone, this is a free country, you're free to, there's nothing wrong with being gay. You're born that way. And by the way, Obama, Clinton, they all voted against gay marriage. So this is
past, not anymore.
This is an evolution. So,
right. Yeah.
So
you know.
We're still waiting for the rest.
It's almost like, all Trump voters are nincompoops. Donald Trump is not a fluke. He won. Then he won again, even more decisively.
Because bigotry and a lot of other things in this country exist, and he picked at those scabs.
You know, that's the point of view of a good chunk of the opposition to Trump. He's not a bigot, and that's frankly nonsense.
grabbing women by the blank, I think, is the definition of a bigot. Saying that all immigrants are rapists and drug dealers,
and
I think
taking
blank
away Henry Johnson's designation, like taking away black people,
renaming Denali,
right?
Can take the black jobs,
Gulf of America.
Are you telling me why did Trump win even more decisively the second time with the most recent election?
Because we had a presidential candidate who was asleep. Okay. And yeah. then you had a black woman who took over.
With 3 months to prepare.
Yeah.
Now, another thing to point out.
And they were saying a woman can't do it.
To that point, the reason
Trump... You're the deniers. The fact of the matter is Trump wasn't a fluke because he talked about things that people cared about. And he won all the swing yeah. states. And it's not because he's a bigot. It's because he has a different point of view
well,
than
many
other
people. Well,
two things
can exist.
But...
Talking
about issues that are important is different than advancing policies that solve those issues. So one of the major reasons, in my opinion, that he was reelected was that there was an inflation surge in 2022 and 2023. If you look worldwide in the history of the post-World War II world, no politician has been reelected under high inflation regimes. Nixon... Ford, Carter, Biden, and that's just in the U.S. And then you can look worldwide at what has been happening in other countries. So there's an economic component, and I agree. It's not just – I 100% agree with you, Mark, that it's not just bigots and him going after cultural issues. But just talking about that is good. But what's his plan for reducing inflation? I haven't heard a word about that. What's his plan for dealing with higher grocery prices? Haven't heard a word about any of these things.
He want Panetta to lower interest rates, which could arguably raise inflation? Or Powell, excuse
yeah,
me.
No, I mean, it seems like he's going about this the wrong way. So I think you're right that he appealed to a lot of voters
yes.
who were frustrated with COVID, the COVID policies, immigration, inflation,
Biden,
all of those that Biden and, you know, a lot of those policies. I 100% agree with you on that. I'm not claiming I don't like when people say that. Everybody who voted for Trump is a bigot. But what you're seeing is a lot. The first tranche of policies that have come out are very, very biased in certain ways. And whether they're culturally biased, like we've been discussing with the Supreme Court decision, or whether they're economically biased, which I know is something else on the docket with the. I hate to say the One Big Beautiful Bill Act in terms of, you know, who's benefiting and who's losing. I think there's a clear pattern of, you know, favoring one group at the expense of another.
Well, we have to take a break now that it's gotten so heated. I think we need to take a deep breath and exhale. We all like each other, and I do appreciate very much that Mark Grimm is here and sharing his side of the story. I think it's important. We all need to discuss these things, and we can still exist and live together peacefully and in harmony. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back. Back on the roundtable, 9 minutes now before 10 o'clock. Some word coming in. We're awaiting what the Supreme Court decisions will be, and we're getting some live NPR coverage, but they're going to let us know when it happens. So, guys, be prepared. I have no idea at this point. We're here with Mark Grimm, professional speaker, speaking coach, and Albany County legislator. Of course, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. And Aaron Pasitti, professor of economics at Siena College. We're talking about the Supreme Court decisions. We have some letters from Elizabeth Pannell to say that having children read a book where Johnny has two moms is not teaching sex ed. It is recognizing that there are kids with two moms out in the world. When I was growing up, there were like 5 TV stations, and that served to help create a common language and touch points. That is gone. If we decide to provide education based on what the parents believe, we lose another touch point that serves to unify the nation. This is flat out wrong and would be terrible for our country. Thanks. Nothing?
Well, yeah. I mean, this kind of taking what we were saying before the break and putting into a different context is like, you know, these issues can be divisive instead of unifying. And as Mark pointed out, you always have the opportunity to opt out, right? There's charter schools, there's religious schools, there's
homeschool,
private mm-hmm. schools. Yeah, right. Exactly. So, but. It seems like by bringing these issues to the forefront of national debate, it seems to have more of a divisive impact than a unifying one.
It seems to me that's accidentally on purpose.
It is kind of, I think it's...
On purpose?
Yeah. Purposively.
Well, I'm just saying they wouldn't admit that.
Right.
Well, can I just say, people want to be heard across the board, and they just want their views to be heard, and they love their kids. And it's not ridicule is never a positive step. Okay, ridicule is never a positive step.
Yes.
And this nation has grown. I remember I talked about the gay marriage where no state believed in gay marriage. It seems ridiculous now. Or even in my lifetime, blacks couldn't sit at the same table as I could in my lifetime.
Yeah.
So we don't talk enough about the progress that's made in civil rights. Heck, we elected a black man president twice. So we've come a long way, and people have evolved to the point we're a much better place now than we were, and we still have our issues.
And isn't that what right now we're arguing over in many ways? Do we want to keep moving forward, or are we looking backward?
But to my point, when I probably overstated the death gasps of a generation that's having a difficult time dealing with the change. Let me moderate that hyperbole. Based on what Mark was saying.
Thank you.
Wait a minute. this is real discussion.
With every major step forward, like the Civil Rights Act, right, Title IX, all of those components that really democratized U.S. society for previously marginalized populations, there's always frictions that will happen in the interim, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
These change. It's not just like it's voted. Boom, schools are integrated, no problems, right? There's always court challenges. There's always friction. These changes proceed at a very slow and glacial pace. So, you know, sometimes there's two steps forward, one step back. Sometimes there's one step forward, two steps back. But like you were saying, when you take the long view going back to, you know, the Civil Rights Act in the 60s, you know, the long view of that has been some fairly substantial progress.
No, I think you're right, Mark. I think there has been tremendous progress in so many areas, but we haven't gone far enough.
And now we're at the next phase.
We're at the next phase of that, yeah.
I mean, there's some ideas that are worthwhile and some that aren't, and that's what debates are about.
Right.
But we talked about this in the break, is people, you know, they don't talk to each other. When Facebook first came out, I said, this is great. I love to debate. I don't post politically on Facebook. It's a waste of time now because I'm attacked. What really stopped me is my friends were issuing their opinions. They were being attacked by these people. I'll tell you something. I'm a county legislator, and we got backpacks for poor kids before they went back to school. I posted a picture of that on my Facebook, and someone attacked me for being a Trump supporter. So this is the kind of madness that is getting in the way of the kinds of debates we've had this morning, frankly.
Yeah. Anything, Sienna?
I think they covered it very well.
Well, let's hear from Diane then. She wrote in to the panel this morning at panel@wamc.org. She says, education is reporting on what has and is happening in the world, making everything beautiful and nothing ugly has never occurred. Life is ugly at times. We cannot teach our children that everything is perfect. And I'm not sure that's necessarily what we were heading at, perfect, but more so the reality of what's around us and what young people are going to face when they leave the home and they have to navigate the world. And not all that stuff is something we're all going to agree on. But then we have to decide, what are our educational institutions about, and what are we going to teach our students so that they are prepared? And in some cases, it may mean that we have to understand there are gay people in the world.
I mean, I think everyone agrees that there's appropriate ages when you should have these kind of sexuality questions, right? But as someone with young children, that's not how you describe it to your young child, right? This person just has two mommies. This person has two daddies. This person only has one mommy. This person only has one daddy. This person's grandparents are taking care of them. You just explain it in the simplest terms. And to try and give a parent the right to not have that kind of educational program in a school or to be able to opt out, it just feels like we're just putting a lot more stress on the teachers. All I can think about is the teachers and what they do day in, day out to try to educate these students. They take care of your kids for numerous hours of the day, and to try to regulate them when they're not even paid well and make it harder for them and to make it even punitive for them to try to teach something, I think we have to be very careful.
Yeah.
As a college professor, we are often maligned as being like these, you know, woke Marxists or whatever. But if any of my students are listening or any people in my department, you know, the way I present economics is like, okay, these are the core concepts. These are the competing schools of thought. And then you compare, you know, why one group's in favor of increased government spending, why one group's in favor of cutting taxes, and then you kind of explain the rationale behind them. I'm not trying to indoctrinate students. I'm trying to give them a perspective so they can make sense of what's happening in their world.
He is Aaron Presidi. That's the last word for the moment. We've got to go over to, you know, the top of the hour, Ray Graff, all that stuff. It's coming up now. Here we are, already discussing before on air. You know, we like to have conversations, and that's exactly what we're going to do with you right now, just after hearing the decision by the Supreme Court. Oh, yeah. Hi, I'm David Giustina. This is the Roundtable Panel. We're here with Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, professional speaker, speaking coach, and Albany County legislator Mark Grimm, and Aaron Presidi, professor of economics at Siena College. In fact, they're both Siena College guys, and then we have Siena, which is spelled differently over here.
Exactly.
We already talked
about
that.
We'll still take her anyway.
All right.
And send your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Here it is from the Associated Press. You just heard it from NPR. We'll repeat it. So we set up the issue here. A divided Supreme Court has ruled that individual judges lack the authority to grant nationwide injunctions, but the decision leaves unclear the fate of President Donald Trump's restrictions on birthright citizenship. The outcome today was a victory for Trump, who has complained about individual judges throwing up obstacles to his agenda, but a conservative majority left open the possibility that the birthright citizenship changes could remain blocked nationwide. The Republican president's order would deny citizenship to U.S.-born children of people who are in the country illegally. Sienna, you started our conversation about this. Now we know what's happened. What do you make of it?
Oh, man, I'm not shocked. I am a bit disappointed. But nevertheless, it is what it is. So what we see happening here is basically the court saying that the judges did exceed their power. And so what they're narrowing the scope of the nationwide injunction power. And basically they're saying that judges have the right to, you know, issue injunctions for the plaintiffs in front of them. And then Justice Kavanaugh said in concurrence that this does not include giving injunctive relief to class action lawsuits, right? So people in that class. And then they also, Kavanaugh also said, which I think is important, I was happy I saw that, is that they also are not limiting the injunction power when it comes to agency orders, the APA. So that's a big deal for us because, you know, when an agency issues something and we need injunctive relief because the agency's order goes, it's federal, so it will go out throughout the whole country. So there's still a little bit of wiggle room, but we're seeing there's definitely some regulations about exceeding the power, exceeding the scope, which we have to remember will affect both parties at different times and different administrations. What does it mean for us today? It means in 28 states, in 30 days, this executive order will take effect. We don't know how. It's an executive order. This means in 30 days they have to kind of promulgate some sort of regulations around it and what have you. I'm trying to figure out in my immigration brain, how does this work? Because according to the INA, Immigration and Nationality Act, minors under the age of 18 cannot naturalize. Naturalize is how one becomes a citizen, right? And so what happens, I'm just trying to figure out what this looks like in practice. But
you're not the only one.
And this means that individuals who are here on an H-1B visa, on a student visa, on a temporary work visa, if they have children here in the country, then their children will be dependents of their H-4 visa, which means dependents of their visa, which means that when the child turns 21, they will need their own visa status here in the U.S. That's what that means. So that means that the child starts going to college here, even before the child completes college, we have to figure out what kind of status they have because they can no longer be under the status of their parent, just logistically. And then obviously the first prong of the executive order is if you're here in the country and you are without status or undocumented, then that child would not have automatic citizenship. But then I think about all the implications. So if someone had temporary protected status and then it ended, were they a citizen because they were under temporary protected status or are they not a citizen? So there's so many wrinkles to this and it's so complex. And in 28 states, we're going to be dealing with that. So
does that include any states around here?
Oh, I didn't look at the 28 states. We'll find out.
What do you think, Aaron?
I wish Sarah Rogerson was here to help explain all of this, but anyway, she's not. So, as Sienna pointed out, you know, this decision cuts both ways. So it's important to remember that President Biden had at least four of his student loan forgiveness plans stopped by an injunction by a lower court judge. So this ruling would have enabled him to proceed with that and to implement that on a much larger scale instead of having it stopped nationwide at multiple junctures. So, you know, it's interesting to see how this is going to lead to, I mean, one, this is going to overwhelm the court system because you're going to have larger class mm-hmm. action suits and individuals filing on their own behalf in states that they know will be friendly. So I think this is going to create a lot of chaos within the court system, and I don't know how that plays out and how the courts are going to be able to handle this. But kind of taking a step back, since I'm not familiar with all of the legal details, is that, you know, the net effect of this, since it's really dealing with birthright citizenship, is to, you know, take the Stephen Miller Trump approach of instilling fear amongst people who are thinking about coming here or people who are thinking about staying here, and to at least, you know, whether it's, you know, it's not necessarily through outright deportations, but to slow the pace of immigration. And like I said at the beginning of this discussion, immigration is a small net positive for U.S. economic growth. By reducing the flow of immigrants, that's going to serve as a headwind to longer-term economic growth. Immigrants have a tendency to create more jobs. They have a tendency, relative to native-born workers, to create small businesses. So that's something that we're not going to see immediately, but that's something that's probably going to play out over decades if, and that's a big if, this whole immigration debate and the end of birthright citizenship stands.
Mark Grimm.
Well, I think this was all brought on because there were judges who were trying to advance a political policy rather than protect the Constitution. And our dilemma is, yes, a judge should absolutely protect the Constitution at every step. But I don't think that's what always has happened. It's just they don't like Trump and they're going to have their own political policy. But as Aaron said, there's going to be Democratic presidents. Mm-hmm. So this is going to apply to them, too. So this is really, and it's confusing, despite Sienna's great efforts to explain it. This is not settled, is the way I look at it. But I do think it sends a message to judges who believe they should set policy rather than the House, mm-hmm. the Senate, and the President of the United States.
Yeah, and it, you know, we were talking about judge shopping. What did you call it, judge?
Forum shopping.
Forum shopping. But part of this decision along party lines is because there's a Supreme Court that has been loaded in Trump's favor, isn't there?
But the liberals vote in lockstep too. So, and I don't know what Amy Coney Barrett. I don't know where she
but
stands.
But the point was to get a majority on that Supreme Court to mm-hmm. prove all his policies. But they haven't done it universally.
But this ruling will apply to Democrat presidents.
Right, sure. Think about this. Here's an interesting counterfactual. Imagine it's 2021, and Biden was able to stack the Supreme Court with a 6-3 supermajority. And you have, you know, he's passing these student loan forgiveness programs, and lower court conservative judges are saying, nope, can't do this. Do you think the Supreme Court would have voted differently if it was stacked with, you know, 6-3 with Biden appointees?
We'll never know.
No, I know we won't, but I'm saying it's an interesting thought experiment.
I think they would have upheld the right to a nationwide injunction. I think that maybe they would have had that long-term look to say, like, this could impact both parties. Let's go back to the Obama administration. We had another immigration where the DREAM Act came up, but for parents, right? Parents who are here. And that was an executive order that Obama instituted, and that was stopped by an injunction nationwide. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and it was found to be like he exceeded his powers. But nevertheless, I mean, that's when he used an executive order against Obama, right? So it's not the first time this has come up in the immigration context. It actually comes up quite frequently in the immigration context that we are up against injunctive relief. And it's just more difficult for us as practice and as an agency when you have these injunctions in various jurisdictions, because we have to, the federal agency has to respond differently depending on where the person is applying from. So it's a lot more work for that federal agency to figure that out.
So can class action lawsuits span states, or are they specific to a state?
Usually we refer it to federal courts. It's states. It's okay. So because the state's going to sue the government, right?
On behalf of...
Because then that's the... Yeah, exactly. On behalf of the states. Or it can be by district, right? Because they're set up by circuits and what have you. So...
But you can have nationwide class action lawsuits. I'm guessing they're just much more difficult to...
Get your class
organize and...
Yeah.
Is all this a sign, too, of the erosion of our confidence in the court system and judges?
I think so. Judges used to be, well, that's great.
Yeah.
In fact, the Supreme Court votes were like 90-6 or something like that. Those days are gone.
It seemed like the respect for the high court has really
diminished. Yeah. Well, they really tear them apart. I don't know who would put their name up for a Supreme Court justice the way they try to destroy. It's personal destruction attempts. Kavanaugh is the classic case, I think. But, yeah, I think the courts have there's less confidence in the courts, and it's a shame. Because they really are the standard bearers for protecting individual rights through the via the Constitution, but in some cases that's not what they're doing.
Yeah, I agree with that. That there's this politicization of previously independent authorities like the Supreme Court, and as we were talking off air, the Federal Reserve. But what I don't understand, and this is kind of a much broader point, is that it's clear Trump wants to govern by executive order, but he's got a majority in the House, a majority in the Senate. This would be a lot more effective if that administration could hunker down and actually pass legislation when they control Congress and the White House. And instead, it's just these flurry of executive orders that go to a lower court, then they go to the Supreme Court. And there's all this ambiguity surrounding it of how it's going to work out. I mean, I think there's a personality issue into why he's choosing to do this. He wants to rule by fiat with the crown and the cape and the throne. But it just seems like I'm surprised that his more sensible advisors aren't saying draft a bill and get it through Congress, right?
Do we know that?
I don't.
It's not that easy, though. Anything. I mean, he doesn't control the House. They got the nutty caucus there that held up the speaker vote for 15 votes. I mean, so he really doesn't control the House. And he wants power. But hello, every president wants power,
sure.
And this tension between the executive order, which I want, and the other ways, that's going to persist no matter whether, Trump has the personality aspect to it. I get that. But the fact of the matter, all the presidents have wanted power, and Biden and Obama had a lot of executive orders. You're seeing more of it because there's more. It's very hard to get anything passed through Congress.
That's the big issue, isn't it?
Right.
And all Americans
this
50-50 recognize it.
But it's America's fault. We're a 50-50 country.
Yeah.
And, the House and Senate reflect that in the presidency. So I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, because I think, we revert to partisanship in the end as opposed to, wait, we do really want to get things solved. So we're kind of our own worst enemy in the end.
Well, this was the case of... And my details are sketchy, but it would have been the fall before Trump was elected, or the summer before Trump was elected, when there was that bipartisan immigration bill that had support.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, nah, we don't vote for it, even though it had bipartisan support.
We got a letter about that.
And would have been some compromise. And it's like, well, if you agree on this and pass it, then I lose all of the platforms I was going to be running on.
Well, that was the Democratic position. That was, frankly, nonsense. It wasn't a very good bill. And they said, this is the only way to solve immigration.
It was a very conservative bill. It was backed by the Republicans.
Yeah,
the
I was going to say
McCarthy. Very conservative. McCarthy was part of it.
Trump fixed it.
Very strong borders.
Trump closed the border in 3 months as an executive. And that's what Biden should have done. And he didn't, because he was for open borders.
But this was much more expansive than just closing the borders in terms of how to have a sensible long-term immigration policy, not just close the borders, deport.
But it was the executive branch is capable of doing it, and Trump did it in 3 months, and Biden could have done it, but he really didn't.
Sure. No, you're right. That was a conscious policy choice on both sides.
Yeah.
Well, I'm conscious of the fact that we've basically run out of time.
Oh, no.
Can you believe it? We were just about to start screaming and yelling. Fist flying? No, of course not. We are the key place to come if you want to have an intelligent discussion, and I can't thank our panelists enough. Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hannah, you're going to be doing a lot of research, I can tell. You're You're going to have to figure out what's going to happen here. Professional speaker, speaking coach, and Albany County legislator Mark Grimm. Can't tell you how much we appreciate your thoughts today. It's very important. Aaron Pacitti, professor of economics at Siena College. You rock, man. I'm sorry we didn't get to Jerome Powell.
It's all right. Listen, that he's got 11 months left in his term. There will be no shortage of Trump versus Powell sparring matches that happen between now and next May. So
thank you all. And thank you, listeners, for checking in. We are headed over to a congressional corner next.